You're listening to the I Love You Keep Going podcast with George Haas. For more information, please visit our website at www.metagroup.org. That's www.metagroup.org.
So welcome, everybody. This is I Love You Keep Going. It is January 18th, 2024, 7:35 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. And I thought I would talk a little bit about authenticity tonight. The question comes up quite a bit. What is it to be authentic? And what is it to be inauthentic? And then the conceptualization of that, so that you're actually appropriately authentic. I often get the question, are you sure you don't mean just being an asshole instead of being authentic? And no, I don't mean that. And then I thought I would relate it to Dunbar's framework for the way that we might consider organizing relationships. When we say authentic, what we really mean is that you're willing to give an expression of your experience of the present moment that is complete and accurate and maps onto the context of the relationship that you have with the person that you are communicating this to. We don't mean that you pull out your scroll of shame and get them to initial every horrible entry that you've collected over the course of a lifetime, so that they know every despicable thing that you've ever done, so that you feel a sense of safety that they won't leave you if they find out about them. A complete representation of your experience of the present moment that is in context to the relationship that you have with the other person, which means some people you're telling everything to and some people you're telling some things to, and that actually is the nature of authentic expression. If you're restricting the full breadth of the information that you might give somebody, the information that you give to them still has to be authentic, still has to be true. But you have no obligation really to tell everyone everything. In fact, it's not productive really to be able to do that. It may not surprise you that not everyone you encounter is scrupulous. Not everyone you encounter is trustworthy. And you don't want to put yourself in a position of vulnerability where you could be harmed, so that you're really restricting your complete expression to the people that have demonstrated that they're reliable and trustworthy, and that you can depend on them. And this needs to be demonstrated. Christian?
George, have you thought about doing a companion talk about how to lie better to people?
Well, those of us who have learned to lie did so at great expense, and it was a terribly excruciating, painful, awful process of learning to do it. Because it was required of us in our childhood experience. Those of us who don't have a good facility at lying have never really had a need to do it. And so we didn't learn. Secure kids who are delighted in, who are encouraged to be expressive of their authentic nature, that beautiful innocence, that wonder at the world from their perspective, have never really have a need to lie, and so they don't lie very well. Those of us who were rejected, who couldn't express ourselves and anticipate a, a, a good outcome, learn to deny the reality of our experience and form it in a way that would be acceptable to our caregivers so that we wouldn't be abandoned. And it was an awful experience to do it. The problem also that comes with that, of course, is that telling the truth is associated with rejection and pain and fear of abandonment. And so it isn't such a simple thing to switch that off once we come out of childhood into adolescence and to our adult lives. And, you know, we grow up in a culture where some things are valued in some ways and some things are not. If you, for instance, if you grew up in the 50s and you were a gay kid, you learned how to lie. There was no way not to lie. And the consequences were horrific if you made a mistake in that way most of the time. But there's lots of things about ourselves that could put us in a position where that would happen. I think now, for a gay kid, it might be better, but it might not be, depending on where you are and what culture you're born in, what the values are. So, when it comes to authenticity, if you're trained that the authentic experience is going to be rejection and abandonment, and it started early in life, it is a real exercise of trying to change that internal landscape so that you can begin to express yourself authentically. And it is easy to get set back in the beginning if you don't pick right in terms of who you open up to. So there's a lot of care that needs to go into this. In Dunbar's formulation, there's above the line and below the line. Above the line, you tell everybody everything. And what that means is you give them a description of your experience of what's happening, still in a way that's meant to be communicative to them. And then you take in their response to that communication and reformulate your experience of what's happening. That's that vital exchange of authenticity. You let people see you clearly, but you don't let anybody see you clearly. You let the people that enjoy the experience of you and are interested in that experience, interested in that representation. So your expectation is not one of risk, right? Your expectation is one of interest and delight and exchange. And so that makes that expression of authenticity pretty fruitful and useful to you. And there's somebody then who expresses themselves completely to you. And there's a mutual enjoyment of that. One of the characteristics of that is that you really enjoy that authentic expression of the other. And they really enjoy your authentic expression, which creates quite a sense of safety and connection. You're not afraid to be rejected or abandoned because they've demonstrated to you that they're not going to do that by you offering them little pieces of trust. They do well with that little piece of trust. You offer them a little bit more. That accumulates over time until you can be free to express yourself, knowing that their response to you is going to be of interest and of helpfulness to navigating this world. So it becomes the great support for your exploration. You're able to express really the things that you need to find out, and they help strategize and help support you in figuring out how to go out and get that. In Dunbar's construction, you have A's and B's. A relationships are people that you take care of on a daily or every other day basis, be relationships on a weekly or monthly basis, people you tell everything to. The main difference between these two is in an A relationship, you commit to the needs of the relationship and you put that ahead of your individual exploration. This is a huge give in that relationship. And the other person then puts their individual exploration in the second position and attend to the needs of the relationship first. So what that would mean as an example, all your life you've been working toward this one thing and you get the opportunity, but it's in New York and you're living with somebody in Los Angeles. You don't say, yes, I'm on the next plane, I'm going to go do that. In an A relationship, you say, that's terrific. Let me talk to my partner and let's see whether we can work that out. And then you negotiate with your partner how that might work, that you were in New York and they were in Los Angeles, where they moved with you to New York in order for you to have that opportunity and what would make it worthwhile for them to do that. And then if you couldn't work it out, you would pass on the opportunity because the needs of the relationship are primary. Individual exploration needs are secondary. But in a B relationship, the needs of your individual exploration are in first position and relational needs are then in secondary positions. And so you would be free to make that choice for yourself and then let everybody know that that's what you were going to do. In this latest iteration of his work, there are C's and D's still, but he makes a distinction between close C's and ordinary C's. Close C's are close to A's and B's, but they don't get enough, they don't receive the time, energy, and resources that would be necessary to make them a B. But you might think of it as the on deck B's are the close C's. In his original work, it was 30 to 40 C's. And in this new iteration, it's 15 or so close C's and then the remaining 15 or 20 more distance. D relationships are what round up the number of 150, his research was really. How many faces can the brain store in terms of recognition? The new work is making a strong distinction between faces that you can recognize in 3D and faces that you can recognize in 2D. 3D faces caps at about 150, and then he adds an E category, which is 2D faces, which he taps out at about 5,000. 1,500 of which you can know some detail about, right? You know, you're going through your Facebook feed and you recognize hundreds of people that you've never actually encountered in person by their photographs. I hope those numbers are in line. What is the agreement that you have with people in terms of what you are sharing with them? One of the things about authenticity is that when you risk exposure and risk a sense of vulnerability, and you're not sure about the level of safety that you have, you often feel a vulnerability, or a sense of danger. You might have, you know, the sense that you've overshared and put yourself at risk. And that's really that piece to pay attention to, so that you are not oversharing and making yourself vulnerable to harm. And particularly if you're moving out of an inauthentic stance into an authentic one, real care needs to be taken here, because you can overshare at somebody who doesn't really value that and put yourself in a compromising position, which will then create an additional barrier to moving toward the authentic expression. Lacey?
Hello. I'm not sure the like the pr how you generally do these talks. It's my first time coming, so questions I'm assuming are okay.
No, it's a totally Socratic way of talking about these things. So it's actually
Okay.
easier for me if you ask questions than if you don't.
Okay, well, what I'm noticing coming up, and just a curiosity, and I wonder if you've touched into these spaces before, but some of the meditation communities also interweave with like we space communities. I don't know if you know of like circling, authentic
Right.
relating. And I got heavily involved with those communities. I'm also very into attachment stuff and everything in that realm. And I'm really just like sitting with this question of how, what's the word? Like useful or beneficial some of these spaces are, because I was like obsessed with them and was leading them, now completely out of them. And as you're sharing here, I'm just like really struck with what you're sharing about this kind of like way in which we actually allow some like trust to build before we share our authentic self. And I'm just kind of speculating at these spaces where you're kind of invited to show up and be absolutely authentic, absolutely revealing to the most intimate degree most people have ever experienced. And then I'm just curious if you have any thoughts on that, given that so many of these spaces especially are intercrossing with the more meditation communities, and wondering if you have any opinion on that, given kind of the topics that we're discussing.
I would hope that the community, those communities that you mentioned, are stressing that you're free to share or not share. In the beginning, of course, the if you emphasize on the freedom not to overexpose yourself and that there's a practice of sensitivity toward that. Then actually what begins to happen is the development of the capacity to do that. Depending on your conditioning, some people grew up in households where those boundaries were never permissible and that you were required to express whatever it is the caregiver wanted to know about your experience with no sense of consent at all. And so you'll enter into a community like that and maybe misinterpret the exercises, and this could even be coming from the leaders that you're supposed to divulge everything and then manage that. But actually, what would be helpful is instead learning not to when it's demanded of you. I know that in Utrecht, where I teach, it's part of the those. Communities, the authentic relating community, and some of the Wilberian stuff. That was always emphasized. Do not overshare. Do not put yourself at risk. Do not leave yourself in a place where you feel exposed and frightened. Instead, practice the boundary of, I don't want to share that. But at the same time, offering an authentic expression up to the boundary that you're willing to reveal so that you begin to really develop that capacity to do that. But you know, we can also look at it from the attachment lens. Disorganized people in particular are vulnerable to this. Mainly because they're socially isolated. They regulate through social isolation. And so when they encounter a opportunity to share that feels initially safe to them, because they've spent so much time alone and because they're ruminating and thinking about all of these things, and they get on a swing, and then way too much information, way too much intimate detail comes in. At the end of it, it's in some sense almost like a purging, but then they feel completely terrified at the end of it. And so they're unable to regulate themselves. And then the other experience that you might begin to develop is the capacity to help somebody regulate when you recognize that they're going to. And so in some sense, that open expression of vulnerable material that is exceeding your agreement with them, then it's your obligation to hold up the boundary, because they seem to not be able to do it. And it's that you need to understand as well what the agreement in the relationship is, and not allow the loss of boundary of someone else. So this is really mentalizing at a level where you're really sensitive to that. It may be fine, and you can tolerate the too intimate expression, but most people can't bear that. And then it will create an obstacle to moving forward skillfully in the relationship that you actually participated in, even though you weren't the one that was oversharing. Is that making sense?
Interesting.
You know, you have obligation to take care of the other person. And if you see they're not holding their boundaries, it's your obligation to care for them in a way that's skillful, so that they're not in a place of being too vulnerable, too frightened about it. And also then you have the burden of what they've shared with you. You want that. This is a consent question.
I was just going to say, I'm appreciating you sharing this, because I just don't think some of these spaces have the nuance of understanding of attachment that you're covering here. And so it's probably why there's like damage that happens, because what you're explaining here is contrary to a lot of the principles of people, sovereign beings. They are self-responsible. You don't actually need all this stuff. So it's just, I love it.
Well, except when you enter into a relationship with somebody, it's supposed to be collaborative.
Right.
It's not two separate entities buzzing around each other. It's supposed to be an engagement and a collaboration to make a relationship that works for both parties. You can't accept one person losing and one person winning. Both people have to have a sense of winning, and it's on you. You may think, "Oh, I'm winning and they're losing, and that's fine." But that isn't actually fine. The other person isn't going to tolerate that forever. They can't do it, and so you're not creating a stable working relationships. You're in transactional relationships or trauma bonding. So when you secure people tend to be in collaborative relationships. Insecure, organized people tend to be in transactional relationships, and disorganized people tend to be in some kind of trauma bonding. So in a collaborative relationship, you take care of the other person in the way that they need to be taken care of. They take care of you in the way that you need to be taken care of. And you teach each other how to do it, which is the collaboration. You teach somebody how you need to be taken care of. Of course, if you're coming from an insecure, disorganized place, you may not know what that is, because you've never had the experience of being well taken care of. And that's where the exploration piece comes in. You try things out. You try different things in terms of expressing care, and the other person receives that and really touches into whether it's working or not. And then you keep adjusting. You express authentically how it's working for you, and they try something else until you really find a way that one person can take care of another that actually works, and then they do that for you. And then you begin to collect this set of care skills for each other, which really, when you see that that's what's happening, it becomes extraordinarily valuable. So you're willing to really put the energy into the relationship that you need to maintain it, because it's unusual to have that in a relationship. The when a lot of times in those communities, part of the issue is that people who don't have good skills and relationships are coming in. And then there's supposed to be a structured space for them to try to express themselves, but because neither person in the, it's an often dyadic experience. Neither person knows what they're doing very well. It's easy to make mistakes. And it's hard to monitor, you know, that we would have 50 people in the room and 25 dyads with three people monitoring. How are you going to do that effectively without necessarily risking? And in the group that we were in, every 5 minutes or so, somebody would yell to the whole room, "Remember not to overshare." And that seemed to work pretty well. Ask for what you really want. Also understand consent, the threat of abandonment. As it turns out, almost all of us will fold in the threat of abandonment if somebody's significant to us. But we won't be able to do it for very long. So it doesn't, it destabilizes the relationships to make ultimatums. It's not collaborative because we all fold. We'll accept any terms not to be abandoned in certain moments. And of course, 2 days later, we can't do it. It's too painful. So we don't. And the relationship is in crisis again. One of the ways that I formulate it is you, if you're not so far down the rabbit hole of inauthenticity that you don't know what that is anymore, which can happen easily enough in depending on how severe the experience of childhood was. But if you still have some sense of what the authentic response of the present moment is, when it arises, you see it. But if in seeing it, you become fearful that you'll be abandoned, or worse, if you express it, the abandonment terror activates. And then the inauthentic thing you can say instead arises in the mind. The confusion, the delusion, to use a Buddhist frame for it, is that if you push into the inauthenticity, it immediately relieves the abandonment terror. And you think, in the delusion, that you're preserving the relationship, but actually you're harming the relationship. That's the delusion. If you push into the authentic expression, it intensifies the abandonment here. And if you can hold the abandonment here, it will dissolve, and then you'll be sideswiped by a wave of terrible sadness. And depending on what your native attachment orientation is, the causes of the terrible sadness will be different. But if you can hold the terrible sadness, you'll come into a place of authenticity. And you do repeat that one time, 10 times, 20 times, 100 times. The abandonment terror reaction to an authentic expression diminishes until you don't really have that anymore. And you're free to be authentic in that way, without that happening. If you push into the inauthentic expression, you're immediately relieved of the abandonment terror, so you feel better. But a little while later, you're angry. You're angry because you're in a place of deprivation, because you haven't been able to express your authentic desire. And even if they did meet what you asked them for, it isn't your authentic desire, so it doesn't matter. And then you're angry, and often you blame them for not creating a space where you can be authentic, even though it's not their obligation for you to express yourself authentically. It's their obligation to receive the authentic expression. And if you don't trust them enough to do that, they're in a position of not being able to help. The terrible sadness for dismissing people is the anticipation of rejection, that nothing that you can do, nothing that you can ask for will be acceptable. and that you have to idealize and suppress a kind of negative response. And when you see that you can express yourself authentically, and you could have been expressing yourself your youth and your adult life, and that you haven't, that's the core terrible sadness. And for preoccupied people, the terrible sadness is related to an abandonment of the self and a constant pretending, constant caring for the other person without really ever attending to what you need. The terrible sadness for disorganized people, because they're on the other side of the trauma line, and actually most of the time it was authentic abuse, authentic trauma in the early relationships. The terrible sadness is a combination of how could the people that were in charge of taking care of you actually done that to you? And then also how, because you weren't successful at recognizing the difference between a perpetrative and a non-perpetrative person, you entered into a repetition of the trauma, the abuse. And that is the core of that terrible sadness for the disorganized people. That's why that offering of a little bit of trust to see how somebody does then begins to accumulate in the people that respond well. And that's what's important. You know, we also could talk about this in terms of view. Secure people think of themselves as capable, and they think of the world as a place that will be responsive to their needs. And the reason that they think that is that in that early experience of infancy, when they were entirely dependent on somebody taking care of them, the person who showed up to take care of them was sensitively attuned to them, attentive to them, took in what their expressions were, mirrored that back, offered a sense of delight in the beingness of this infant, this child, and then took care of their needs. So that cycle of the child presenting their needs, the somebody there to receive that information, interpret it appropriately, and then actually provide the care that the child needs creates that I'm capable of getting my needs met just by expressing myself, and the world will respond and take care of me. That's that secure loop. In dismissing adults' childhood experience, which is shaped by profound neglect and often by rejection, the experience of that child is that there's nothing I can do to express myself, to get my needs met. I have to be attentive to my caregiver. I have to idealize for them. I have to suppress everything that's negative. And so they learned that as a way of navigating the world. We talk about that often. We are all born autoregulators. And if somebody comes well enough that we reorient to an external regulation, then we depend on somebody else to regulate us. Then if they come reliably enough, we begin to learn the ways that they take care of us so that we can self-comfort. And that supports our exploration so that we can regulate our emotions enough to really go out and explore. And then come back to the person who helps us regulate when we need them. And they're reliably there and will take care of us. Jim?
Yeah, I've never quite understood what you mean by this. What do you mean when you say that we're all born auto-regulators? Because it just seems to me that babies can't really regulate anything without help.
No, they are, they're dependent on the care of other people. But, and this is through observation, obviously, infants are not talking to us. I don't know why. there's a lot of gestures that infants use that are regulating, like sucking their toes or sucking their thumb, rocking, or all sorts of different things, which they tend to do and is organized without reaching out for somebody else to come. And then around, say, 3 months, between 3 and 5 or 3 and 8 months, they become oriented to the person who comes to take care of them. If somebody comes to take care of them. If nobody comes to take care of them, they don't really move out of that self-organization of regulation. So in the strange situation, which is a way of evaluating the attachment strategy for infants and young children, what you'll notice in a child that's organized in that way, they don't look to the caregiver for regulation. They regulate themselves. In the strange situation, an avoidant child will come in and start playing with the toys, but they don't really check in with the caregiver for permission or reassurance. When the caregiver leaves, they don't really acknowledge the sense of the caregiver leaving. This is maladaptive. Of course, infants are not maladapted in that sense. They're just developing in the way that we normally do. Is that helping?
Can you go into a little bit more about why it's maladaptive? Because, I'd be like, I struggle sometimes with being able to regulate my own emotions, and I wish I could auto-regulate more without reaching out to other people,
Yes, I do. But I want to adjust your perception of that a little bit. Autoregulating is usually done through things and usually done through intentional focus away from emotional experiences onto non-emotional experiences. What I think you're really talking about is what we would call self-mastery. And in self-mastery, you learn strategies that are emotionally regulating that you can use yourself to support your being able to go out into the world and explore. But in collaborative relationships, there's always the understanding that the self-regulating strategies that you learn are not necessarily going to work in every situation. And when you're dysregulated and can't regulate yourself, what you need to do is come back to the social network that you've built that is going to help you re-regulate. So in a collaborative model, self-mastery is both the ability to regulate yourself really well and also the understanding that when you can't do it, you come back to a group of people who will help you re-regulate. Not auto-regulating. When you look at adults who auto-regulate, you see a high level of addiction, high level of process addiction. That's what they're using to regulate. And really, what we want to do is orient toward other people to help us regulate when we can't regulate ourselves. And all you have to do to get that is to be willing to regulate them when they're dysregulated and can't regulate themselves. That's the collaborative piece. Yes, go explore, go out to the ends, get completely knocked sideways, come rushing back, and we'll catch you. And then, when we rush out and we really go for the edge of what's meaningful to us and get knocked sideways, you'll catch us. And that's the collaborative way. Otherwise, you're going to get strung out. And fentanyl and meth is really bad at the Lacey?
This question might be a little complex for right now. It's just something I've been wondering about. And when you're speaking about people that are secure functioning, for example, I'm just thinking of someone in the community I'm in who's very secure functioning, and his demeanor is that the world is a good place, relationships are a good place, he believes positively of you, and people respond to that. They're like, oh, this person
Right.
holds me in a positive view. And he actually has chosen, he was a Vipassana meditator, to not focus on negative, and if, even if he sees it, to like see it as a sensation and kind of dissolve it and not pay attention. It's an interesting strategy. And I wonder if someone like myself or other people I know who have more insecure attachment systems, I'll tend to see qualities of people that are untrustworthy sometimes or more shadowy characteristics. And I wonder if my perception is oriented toward is what is true, or if it's my particular wounding or attachment, insecure attachment that has me see the world or people as more untrustworthy. Whereas again, I see my friend who's just, he doesn't ever see those qual, he doesn't focus on them. They're not even in his
Right.
reality, it seems. So I wonder which one. I sometimes am like, I should change and orient to, like towards just looking at the positive or not seeing the untrustworthy or the incongruencies in people. And I guess I'm wondering if you have advice for a more skillful way of like navigating perception.
I sometimes call that the arrogance of the secure.
Yeah, it's so annoying.
What they're leaving out, maybe they don't notice that it is if you're not reliable, they don't flow energy into the relationships. And it's completely natural. There's no abruption, there's no conversation. They just you're not reliable, and they flow energy away toward reliable people. So they're self-selecting secure people who are responsive, and they won't really be in relationships with people who are not. Whereas insecure and disorganized people don't make that distinction. And so they often enter into relationships with people who are not reliable. And there's a lot of conflict around it takes a lot more energy to be in a secure functioning relationship than in an insecure functioning relationship. And so a lot of times we withdraw. Well, we don't. We are abandoned by the secure people without comment because we don't actually support the relationships well enough. And so there's a kind of self-selecting out of relationships to secure people if you're insecure, disorganized, because you don't actually show up with the skill set that they expect at the baseline. And because they're oriented to a world that's filled with people who will take care of them, they just move naturally toward those people, away from people that don't do that. So that's how that perception is, which I think of as arrogant, in terms of not really seeing the distress that some people are in because of their conditioning. So. But I do like the view. I'm capable of getting my needs met, and the world is receptive to me and will meet my needs, is a great way to move around the world. And yes, you can move around that world. And because that's your view, that's the world that's there. And if you have the view that people are untrustworthy and dangerous and you have to be on guard, then you create a sense of yourself on guard and a sense of the world is dangerous. And you move through the same environment as if that's what it is. That's the nature of view, mind states. And so that's why the mentalizing piece is so important, so that we can really track that. And then working on developing a database that actually has the possibility of seeing the world as responsive and seeing yourself as capable. That's really what the Ideal Parent Figure Protocol is about, that aspect of it. So that you create conceptual reality in a process that's very ordinary. You have the capacity to sense an object that can be sensed if there's contact. Consciousness of that sensing experience arises. It's evaluated for urgency. Does it need immediate attention? Does it not matter whether we get to it? Is there time for a pleasant experience? And then as each item comes up to the top of the queue, it's compared to the perceptual database. And if there's an entry that is close enough to the present moment experience, then all of that meaning of all of those previously experienced moments like that is attached, and it flips into conceptual reality. And there we are in this reality that has all of the meaning. Some of those threads go all the way back into early childhood. And then we're in that meaning. We don't actually live a life of what's happening. We live a life of what's happening means to us. And so when you change the database, you can change the way that the present moment means to you really easily, since it's not actually, it's never been what's happening. It's always been what it means to you. And if you change the meaning of it, you change reality in that sense.
Sign me up.
We have a level two starting on Friday, as it turns out. That's tomorrow, the 19th.
I'll be writing an email.
10:30 in the morning. I think. Yep. So what's remarkable, what I think is so remarkable about this thing, the thing that I find actually the most amusing, is that the self-experience doesn't change that much. You just do things completely differently than you did before, and you see the world completely different than you did before, but it's the same self-experience experiencing it. So it doesn't seem like you've done anything, even though you've done all of this work to develop your capacity to mentalize, to develop your capacity to emotionally regulate. You've learned the skill set of secure functioning, so you have that to offer. And then you've changed the database so that you've remade the, you don't remake what happens in the past, you remake what the past means. And there's a lot of room to change what the past means, even though it doesn't change what happened. So. Shall we do some meditation? What do you think? Vipassana or metta?
Metta.
Metta. Okay. So go ahead and settle in. How's that? So we are starting a level two tomorrow at 10:30 a.m. It's on the website if you want to take a look at it. And then at 7 in the evening, I'm giving a workshop on meditation and addiction, which is our approach to recovery, which really talks about four modules, three which are meant to help develop emotional regulation strategies so that you can replace the substances and processes with that. And then a look at the attachment system from the addiction perspective. So take a look at that. I am going to do a retreat in Poland in May, May 11th to May 25th. So if you like to travel, and then I'm going to do it. A non-residential retreat in Utrecht in at the end of May and the beginning of June. So that's coming up. We will have in February, the last three Saturdays of February, addiction intensive. So really focusing on meditation strategies for addiction. So take a look at that. I offer the teaching freely, but I do hope that if you're resourced and you can, you'll make a donation. There's a link on the website to do that. Any amount is helpful. It helps support me and also the work that Meta Group is doing. Thank you for coming. Really appreciate your practice, and we'll see you soon, I hope. Bye now.
Thank you, George.
Thanks.